Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne on 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month and rebroadcast on the third Monday. And if you enjoy podcasts or you've missed part of the show, you can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select the podcast tab. This month, we are featuring National Safety Month. And being a pediatrician, I've changed it a bit to focus not only on child safety, but also the changes in child rearing recommendations over the years. Incorporating research into child safety and health, including mental health, which I've always said includes the growth and development of both the infant, the child, and the parents, has always been an important part of pediatric and family practice. I'm happy to welcome Dr. Andrew Viscara, pediatrician at Kinnickzu Community Health, who is here with me today as we discuss child rearing recommendations and child safety. Welcome, Andrew. Please introduce yourself to our listening audience.
Yes, thanks so much again for having me back. Like Joanne said, I work at Kinnickzu Community Health in their pediatric department, along with several other of our wonderful pediatric providers. And it's just such a big blessing to be part of this community. We love it. Thanks for having me.
Susie Perez is also here in the studio to help me present the show to our listening audience. Welcome, Susie.
Well, thank you. And just a little bit, I wanted the listeners to know a little bit about you, Dr. Joanne. Dr. Joanne Royans is a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously hosting segments of Otto's Eclectic Music Mix, and is now hosting Medical Musing, which, as we know, airs on the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. Dr. Joanne is a mother of four children and the wife of KRFY broadcaster John Royans, who is the host of Jazz Over Sandpoint.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're so lucky to have you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Susie. Between Andrew and me, we've had 54 years of child rearing experience. That includes our time as parents, as pediatric residents, and of course, as pediatric practitioners. As a pediatrician, my personal experience combined with my medical knowledge, willingness to listen, and investigate parental concerns all contributed to my value as a trusted expert source for my patient population. Doctors who care for children must be good listeners and good communicators, and I know that Andrew is such a person. We know parents have multiple concerns about their infants and children and bring a certain amount of anxiety and stress regarding their additional responsibilities, adding childcare to their family and work schedules. And there's a multitude of pediatric advice books. In my case, I went from Dr. Spock as a parent to T. Barry Brazelton, who wrote a wonderful book called Touchpoints, Barton Schmidt, Your Child's Health, and then the wonderful books from the American Academy of Pediatrics. We even used Barton Schmidt's telephone protocol book, and I reviewed every protocol with the nurses as the protocol book for our phone nurses. So what did you use, Andrew? And I'm sure you give out handouts. We all worry sometimes that they end up on the parking lot, but they're very good to reinforce the important points that you've discussed with the parents.
Yeah, you know, a word on that is, I remember after having my first child, just comparing what I knew to be true from then being a parent to what I told families before I was a parent. And I would just shake my head and I thought, man, some of the things I would say that were unknowingly just not empathetic at all because I didn't understand deeply what families were going through until I had my own. And I often wonder, you know, my child's only six, I have a 3 and a 6-year-old. And so I still wonder, what am I telling those families of a 12-year-old that just don't make any sense? And I'll find out when my boys turn that age, you know. But, you know, obviously, a lot of my resources come online. I think, though, from the books that I have recently encountered, I will plug another one published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and that's Lighthouse Parenting by Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg. And It uses the metaphor of a lighthouse, basically being something that's stalwart, strong, and a guide for, you know, for kids. And that is you, the parent, and making sure that you are centered as your parent, as somebody who is, who's, you know, who's a guide for your child, and something that's immovable, but not hovering.
Not a helicopter.
Exactly. Not a helicopter, not moving with the kid, but instead, you know, giving them guidance. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful metaphor for how to look after yourself as a parent in a way that's really beneficial to your child. Yeah, so that's one that I'll definitely plug
that I've enjoyed reading. I'll have to look that up. Well, we have multiple topics to address, so let's start with the Back to Sleep campaign. In the 70s and 80s and before, we were promoting infants sleeping on their tummies, and that was a difficult one because if you were nursing or bottle feeding, you were feeding an infant face up. You had to disattach, turn them over, and lie them down without activating the startle reflex. Mm. And that was always a little difficult. And then 1994 came and the Back to Sleep campaign started. And I remember being called by a radio or TV station and going, oh, I guess I'll have to research more of this recommendation, because obviously I had come out of the years of having babies lie on their tummies. But it actually showed, the research showed that sleeping on their back did decrease the risk of sudden infant death and aspiration. So, but it was so ingrained. Tell us about your experience and your recommendations.
So as you said, you know, the year that that campaign launched for, you know, the Back to Sleep, the AAP first was in 1992, and then later the U.S. Surgeon General really paid the emphasis on there in 1994. At that time, the data showed that there were 154 deaths per 100,000 childbirths resulting in sudden infant death. And after 5 years, that rate fell to 113. And after another 5 years, the rates were at 94. And then the lowest that they've been in 2011 is 86 deaths. And again, compare that to the original of 154. It's in a tremendous effect. And so we do. Now we recommend that all children be placed on their back when they sleep. There were some original recommendations that that said, hey, back to the side. And then since then, we've just been able to hone in on specific risk factors. And really, the way I kind of think about this, the way I present it to families is, you know, saying, okay, we know that families are diverse and a large mixture of everybody's habits, including parents and babies. So if you take the highest risk person, that's going to be, you know, an infant who is exposed to multiple substances during the pregnancy, and then born into a family where substance use is still a thing, be that cigarette smoking, be that alcohol, et cetera. Co-sleeping with a parent in a really soft bed with a bunch of blankets around and all the teddy bears known to man, you know. And so that is your highest risk scenario. And
as your risk for SIDS.
For your risk for SIDS. Thank you. And so as you start to peel away all those factors in your own life, you can start to see that risk decrease and decrease and decrease. Now, when we're making large public health pushes, we're going to zero in on one recommendation that's going to make the greatest effect, one that's simply applied. And again, that ended up being, let's put our kiddos on their back to fall asleep.
Yeah, it's interesting because basically you also have grandparents. And so you have many factors. I remember, and I'm going to be off subject, I know, but someone, a baby was towing in, and I kept saying, no, when the baby starts to walk, their pressure is, the orthopedic surgeons are doing much less. It wasn't as severe. And every time they came in, grandma says that so-and-so was casted. It's like, okay, we can wait a little longer. Mm-hmm. You know, but again, there's always the people who remember what they did in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s that also come into play. Mm-hmm. And of course, the internet. Cribs were also a concern. And so when we were first having children, it was the slats that they needed to be narrow enough that the infant couldn't put their head through them.
Right.
And so hand-me-down cribs were discouraged. And then in 2011, when some of my grandchildren were born, the United States Product Safety Council actually banned drop side cribs. So those are the cribs that had the little springs and you would drop the side. So now the side just bends over, right? It doesn't work on a spring.
Yeah.
It just, you know, or it has one side that's a smidge lower than the other.
Yep.
And the decorators of rooms, I mean, crib bumpers and mobiles are discouraged.
Yeah,
so,
those are all the bumpers. I mean, it's all, no, for us.
All
now.
The matching, you know, bed skirts and bumpers are no longer recommended. So, as you said, no co-sleeping, avoiding soft bedding. Pacifiers are actually good because kids need to suck and that's sort of calming. So, basically, as you were talking too, by 19, there was actually a warning against inclined sleepers and wedges and sleeping in the car seat.
That's right.
And, you know, even the infant seat. But the original infant seat that we had when we carried a baby was like plastic. I mean, it was not very, you know, sturdy.
Secure.
Absolutely. Susie, listening to some of this, just I think my son had a lot of guardian angels because we had bumpers. We had the slats were wide. Yeah. We had everything wrong. He slept on his stomach, slept in the bed with us. And so, yeah, he did survive. But it's good that these kind of studies happen so that less, as you say, the incidences of SIDS has gone down so much because of paying attention to the needed changes.
Well, and you make such a great point because it's incumbent on, you know, on doctors, pediatricians, it's incumbent on scientists to speak with their humanity as well as their scientific facts. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the original data point that I quoted to you, 154 deaths per 100,000 childbirths, means that your chances of this happening are thankfully already quite small. Now, I would never, ever quote that stat to one of those 154 families. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tell my patients. It's, you know, yes, your rate, let's talk any risk at all. And I have lots of discussions around risks for certain things. You know, I'm not telling you that you do all these things and your child's going to pass. Absolutely not. But I don't know of the 100,000 kids that I see every day, which one of those is going to be one of the 154. And I can't tell you otherwise, and you don't know, and I don't know, but I can tell you what you can do actively to not become one of those and to significantly reduce your rate of risk, right? And so risk is such an invaluable tool, and it is interpreted in so many hundreds of thousands of ways, and it is used manipulatively, it is used correctly, and it is incumbent on us as physicians and scientists to use risk in a way that's responsible, and again, that brings in our humanity as well as the humanity of the people we're talking to so that they understand. So like you said, absolutely, guardian angels were there. Also, chances are you're part of the other, I don't know, I can't do that math quickly, but of the other children who did just fine, right?
But yeah, it's babies that did die of SIDS are so still prominent in my mind.
Oh, me too.
And one was the twin, a five-week-old twin that nuzzled up to the other twin. They were sleeping in the same bed. And the other was the babysitter. And so the important point is, always include your, you know, your child sitters about the back to sleep recommendation because one, you know, happened at the babysitters. I'm sure there are more, but the one that really stands out in my mind. Also, what we, you know, spitty babies, colic is normal about 0 to 3 weeks. Babies are really good. And then suddenly they wake up and say, hello, world.
Yeah.
And they have nothing to do. And so they cry, you know. And then, you know, they spit. That's a very short track between your stomach and your nose and your mouth. And parents get really upset. And so lots of spitting is normal. But we kind of went through the you know, would it be reflux? Should I treat the reflux with a medicine?
Yeah.
And that's where the wedges came in.
Yeah.
And so there are still people using wedges and there are still sudden deaths from using those wedges, incline wedges. You could be on your back, but if you slide down, so you have to have a way that they don't slide down. And now they're not recommended at all.
That's right.
In fact, in 2022, there was a federal law banning the sale of drop side cribs and crib bumpers. And reinforcing the back to sleep. So the next question about sleep concerns how to improve the nighttime sleep schedule. Because so many parents are, you know, going to walk, feed continually. And sometimes the pediatrician doesn't get how stressed the mom is. You know, how are you feeding? Oh, I'm feeding every 3 to 4 hours. Well, but she's not sleeping in between, and she doesn't say that, and the baby's gaining weight, or I'm feeding every 3 hours, or now it used to be that maybe pediatricians didn't even ask about night sleeping. Mm-hmm. So I would always say when they got to be 6 months, 8 months, walk a little slower. You know, if you're starting food, you know, you can, you know, maybe they're just going to make a noise and go back to sleep on their own. So if you hop up all the time, then you're going to create the every 2 to 3 hour schedule as they get older. So what do you say, Andrew?
I like that. Walk a little slower. I may have to steal that from you. What I say is, and here's the thing about the parenting books, and when it comes to sleep training and feet, like, oh my word, you're going to get advice that is so mixed and has everything to say. So I try to lead with curiosity and lead with empathy and tell folks, hey, what I tell them is, what's your number? Basically, when your infant begins to cry, how long does it take for you to respond? And your number is your number. I actually don't care what that number is. That number could be 2 seconds. It could be 30 seconds. That's just your number. Do not express any morality when it comes to that number, right? And what you do is slowly, maybe on a week-by-week basis, you decide, I'm going to increase that number by 30 seconds, right? That way we all know it's safe. What's half a minute? It's fine. That eases your mind. You know your baby's fine. We're just going to increase it by 30 seconds. And guess what? Next week, we're going to go another 30 seconds. It's going to be a progressive thought. You know, you're making progress as you go. But I'm not going to attach it to a fixed time because that's just not how life works. It's not the reality. And so many patients are so different. I have families who really do the kind of just let baby alone at 4 months and they'll figure it out and here we go. And I have families who are picking the baby up every 2 seconds. And again, you know, there's some general guidance around that, but that's kind of how I
And it's the parent personality that comes into it.
Very
the parent,
much so.
The confidence they have, basically, in being a parent. Susie?
Well, it seems like there's different avenues for a young parent, a new parent, to find out things. There's the pediatrician. There's the grandmother. There's the mother. There's the friends. Lots of opinions.
That's right.
But are there opportunities for parenting classes? Would that be a helpful thing? And how do pediatricians stay on top of the new ideas, the new thoughts?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are a number of parenting classes. Unfortunately, here in our local area in Sandpoint, I'm not familiar with the number one classes that are around. I would say that whatever source you have, be that your grandparent, your in-law, your friends, the best advice to give is somebody who to get advice from is somebody who has a listening ear, just like Joanne said at the beginning statement, is so important. Somebody who first listens before they give advice and who's not attached to a, we're talking about changing recommendations today, right? Which means that science and pediatricians are willing to be wrong and update their recommendations. If you're taking advice from somebody who's very prescriptive and who is always right, maybe try again. And so if you come into a parenting class that is such, that just says, hey, this is the only way to go about it, I would come with a more empathetic mindset.
Yeah, know your sources. I was just thinking pediatricians are very busy people, but they could have a newsletter that they send out to their patients, their families. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole nother thought process.
Actually, now with the internet, so many practices do have a website, and on the website they you know, will discuss certain concerns, so like, you know, sleeping or feeding or this or that. So there are, you know, different ways that pediatricians get the news out to parents, and now with websites I imagine that it's even easier in some ways. But you want your website to be number one because lots of times if you just go to the internet there are other opposing ones, if, you know, basically if you're just looking up a specific concern like sleeping. And again, it's scheduling. I remember, you know, every 3 hours, every 4 hours, we were never the same. It wasn't like every day we fed at 7, 10, 1, because it takes a different amount of time to feed, a different amount of time to get the child back to sleep.
That's right.
You know, so it was never very rigid at those 0 to 4 months. When you're really working on or just taking care of the child. I mean, that's the hug 'em, rock 'em, love 'em stage. And you're not really instituting that much. But it's, you know, again, just that walk a little slower as they get a little older. And, you know, if you could stick the pacifier back in, if you could turn on music, you can't turn on the mobile anymore, but you could, you know, turn on some lullaby kind of music too. Yeah. And sometimes you can get away with that. There's a couple books. One, I mean, people talk about Ferber or Ferberizing their child. That's the, well, that's really the, you know,
yeah. Oh,
at
yeah.
a certain
yeah.
time, parents might have to do that. But
sure.
then there's Baby Wise and mm-hmm. another one, The Baby Whisper. And the one thing was easy, eat, you know, eat, activity, sleep, time for you. And, you know, so basically that was kind of, that's also a good sort of recommendation.
Absolutely.
So basically what to finish up on, what the listeners need to know is the recommendation is back to sleep. No soft bedding, but once they can roll over, don't drive yourself crazy.
Please.
Children can be in blanket sleepers. They can stay warm. But yeah, you don't have to run back in the room every time.
Let me add to that. That's what makes tummy time so, so essential. When your baby is awake, put them on their tummy so they can do their little push-ups. Because that way you kind of know, hey, if my baby, once my baby is flipping from back to front, you also know that they can push up and push their little head up and turn their little head and be just fine. So it helps you, again, not be so stressed out and, you know, looking at them every 5 minutes to see if they turned over.
Well, tummy time is really important too. It used to be the kids that slept on their back had very flat heads on one side, and then we had to deal with whether they need to have a helmet.
A helmet, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so basically doing tummy time is so important in that activity time.
Yeah.
Next, we're going to address food and how do you add food and food allergies. Have we decreased food allergies? Have we increased food allergies? So many recommendations have changed over the years. In the 70s and 80s, originally I was told to feed cereal at 3 weeks, rice cereal at 3 to 6 weeks, fruits at 2 months, vegetables at three
wow.
months. And then they flipped. Introduce vegetables first. You don't want them hooked on sweet fruits. And then it was wait till 6 months for wheat. Meat varied from 6 months to 8 months, then back to 4 months. So, I mean, no wonder parents are a little, you know, confused.
Sure.
Certainly the recommendation to introduce one food at a time is important to watch, you know, for a few days to make sure that they're not having any reactions. And eggs at 8 to 12 months, and then kind of eggs got, you know, pushed even back farther.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became no peanuts until 3 was a very serious recommendation because that's a risk of aspiration.
Sure.
And that peanuts, but nobody said peanut butter mm-hmm. or peanut products.
Yep.
And so somehow by 2000, it got sort of twisted, not twisted, but actually an AAP recommendation came mm-hmm. out. Not to introduce peanut products until age 3, because it was thought that we were going to decrease the incidence of peanut allergy. But lo and behold, we increased the incidence of peanut allergy.
That's right.
And I was telling Andrew before that I didn't hop on the recommendation because I had personal experience. My husband's allergic to eggs. I introduced them at maybe 9 months and watched, and all 4 kids can eat eggs. They didn't have eczema with it. They weren't throwing up. They didn't seem to have any problems. And but basically, as we got more strict about things, we found an increase in food allergies. So we're back to introducing them early. So what do you do?
Yeah. So that has certainly changed. I found a paper that was titled Food Allergy Prevention Through the Decades. An ounce of humility is worth a pound of cure. And it's just so true. Science, we're using science as this beautiful tool that is inherently curious and humble because it takes the hypothesis of, well, the theory that I have is probably wrong. And then you go about trying to prove that it's not wrong. But ultimately, we accept that our assumptions are incorrect. That's science. But we're all also human, which means we make these recommendations in a bold way that says, nope, this is the way you have to do it. And we see that. Boy, not being humble comes back to get us.
I'm just thinking of one incident when I worked at a private school. I was in the kindergarten, and a little girl looked up at me during snack time, and she said, I am gluten and dairy intolerant. Mm-hmm. So she had a special snack. The next year in first grade, she was at a birthday party in the classroom eating cake and ice cream. And so in my thinking, you know, I think it's probably a good idea for parents not to intellectualize all this stuff with the kids. Yeah. So you can talk to that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I see it so much. So what we do, what we've recommended since 2015, there is a trial called the LEAP trial, L-E-A-P. And listeners can go look it up because it's just absolutely fascinating. And what we have found is that early introduction is best, particularly when it comes to those high allergen products like peanuts and eggs, et cetera. And there is obviously some nervousness because it's a complete flip-flop, right? Like you said, avoiding all peanut products till three to saying, hey, you're 4 month old, I want him to have some peanut butter.
Thin layer.
Yes, a thin layer or some peanut powder, et cetera. Yeah. And so even around that, you saw some kind of not fudging. They're like, okay, we'll do that. But maybe if you have a family, like a family member with peanut allergy, maybe you should draw some IgE levels, et cetera. And then slowly in 2020, that went away as well. And it's just your blanket statement now. And so what we think is going on is that our immune systems, again, these babies with really healthy immune systems are growing accustomed to all sorts of things in their environment, including things that are in their gut. And we want their immune system to see something like a peanut product and say, hey, I'm used to that. It is not dangerous. I do not have to overreact here. And that is regardless of siblings who have allergies, et cetera. Most food allergies really are not inherited or genetic. It's quite rare is really what I should say that would be the case. And so that's what we recommend now. Is to introduce these, egg product or peanut product or seafood product, that kind of thing, to do so early, of course, in a responsible way to where your child's not going to choke on it, right?
Yeah, that's wonderful because I, too, read the LEAP study and then I can't remember if it was part of the LEAP study or a different study, that Israeli children were giving peanut powder at 4 months, and Jewish children in the UK were recommended not to have any, and the Jewish children in the UK had more allergies than the Israeli children who were given the peanut powder, which I thought was another interesting thing. So basically, there's the recommendation from your doctor, and hopefully the doctor has common sense, I guess, so that they give you good recommendations for your child. It could be different for each child for certain reasons. So that's the important part of listening to your medical provider.
And one of the things I do for some of my families, obviously this is a very nerve-wracking topic and nobody wants to have the poorest result for the child. And so sometimes what I do on rare occasions is I say, guess what? Why don't you just bring that food with you to your next visit and we'll do this together. And you can have this room and we'll hang out. And you know, I'm here. If anything happens, it's not going to, but if it does, why don't you do that first trial here in office? And families are thankful for that.
That's basically interesting because that's what the allergist would do for MMR, that they would have the child come in and eat a peanut product in their office or an egg product before they got the MMR. The peanut product was more just to see if they really had an allergy. It was basically before they did big testing on them. But I remember actually having a child. The parents thought they had peanut allergy and they came in and he did. I mean, he had hives. So we had the epinephrine there.
Exactly.
And that's the safe part is that we had the epinephrine.
And I will say too that there's not any, by way of recommendation, any preemptive blood tests that I'm recommending or that show any effect. You know, often if you have an event, yeah, that's a great reason to see an allergist. But I would just caution and really just kind of beg people not to spend loads and loads and loads of their own well-earned money to do any kind of blood test that's guaranteed to show them that they're allergic to A, B, or C, or D, E, and F. In my experience, have just not been useful to families. And so I would just caution and say, hey, if you do have a question, let's get you set up with an allergist and do this properly.
I'm thinking it's probably also important, and you may have already said this in some way, to be careful about the internet. Mm-hmm. My personal doctor says, go to Cleveland Clinic or Mayo Clinic. Don't just take stuff off the internet, because it's on both sides. Mm-hmm. It can go either way. So have reputable sources for your information.
That's right.
Yeah, those are the sources now. When people ask me a medical question, I want to make sure that my information is still up to date. If it's a child, for the Academy of Pediatrics, but then Cleveland Clinic and Mayo are probably the sites that I look at the most, because it was interesting to me. I was looking at something last night, and some recommendations have changed, and AI, which is the first thing on my search engine, was not up to date. I mean, literally, the recommendations had changed in the last several years, and it was not up to date. It was saying exactly what was previously. So you always have to be careful on the internet. We used to call it, Dr. Google.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to take a short break, or at least I'm going to do a station ID. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY Ponderay and in Sandpoint. Just a little brief thing about cord care. We were wondering if we were going to skip it, but I thought what Andrew told me before was very interesting. So back in the 70s, extending up to my children, they used gentian violet. It was purple, stained that beautiful onesie that someone gave you for your baby shower. And then they changed to alcohol because they thought perhaps the gentian violet was too annoying and too difficult, or whatever. The nurses had it all over their hands too. I'm not really sure. But alcohol, and then just let it dry on its own. The biggest thing is don't cover it completely. So again, the diaper being up, the onesie, and then another outfit and another outfit. I mean, I've had children come in with four layers on when they were, I couldn't see them for a rash, but that's another topic also. So anyway, just keeping it dry. So tell me what the research that you've seen recently. I thought that was very interesting.
So it's a beautiful example of where, quote unquote, common sense meets science. And so I think the recommendation of cleansing the whole area, using alcohol or the dye to cleanse the bacteria so we don't get infection. I mean, that sounds like common sense, right? Infection around that umbilical cord and around the umbilicus in general can make a baby very, very sick. And in fact, we still do recommend cleaning with chlorhexidine in like third world countries, right? You're thinking the scissors to cut the umbilical cord were not sterilized, you know, conditions that I saw childbirth back when I was in Peru, those kinds of things. Like, you're just really kind of a very dirty environment. Yes. Okay. Let's get rid of a big portion of the dirt or the bacteria in that area. However, what we now know is the drying of the umbilical cord is kind of a wonderful process that has to do with inflammatory cells that are naturally supposed to be there that are contracting the blood vessels in the area and drying them out, as well as bacteria that are actually helping in that process. And so if you use dye or alcohol to clean off that bacteria and kill the inflammatory cells, you're going to end up with an umbilical cord that stays on the baby for longer, thus representing more risk that bad bacteria get in the area and cause, again, infection. So what they found is that if you just let in a first world country like our own, where everything's kind of sterilized and clean, right? If you just let the umbilical cord dry, it'll fall off in an average of, 4 or 5 days. If you use the little alcohol swab over and over and over again, it takes about 12 days. That's three times as long to fall off. And so now we let the good bacteria do its work. We let the inflammatory cells that are there contracting those blood vessels do their work, and the umbilical cord falls off.
And we let it dry.
And we let it dry. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Now we're getting into vaccines, and we're not going to go over every vaccine, but I picked a couple that I thought were important.
Please.
Or the history of it. And new and better vaccines don't get promoted enough by pediatricians and medical people. So, and it's so ironic that parents don't know and understand the illnesses that vaccines prevent because we've been so successful with the immunization program. So we hope as pediatricians and family doctors that your medical provider, your nurse practitioner, your PA are a parent's trusted source and that they read the same things that we do. You asked how we keep up to date, and Susie, we actually get little blurbs from the Academy of Pediatrics that sometimes are super common sense, but sometimes are what's new in the media. And so that kind of directs you to the, you know, to looking that up or reading about it. But anyway, meningitis. And it's so interesting to me when the newspaper reports, oh, someone died of meningitis. They're just big lumpers. And usually, though, it's Neisseria meningitidis. And that can cause a terrible disease. And college student, there's always an article about a college student or a high school student they thought had the flu, and suddenly in 36 hours, they've passed away.
That's right.
And it's usually Neisseria meningitis. There are certainly cases of viral or fungal or aseptic, which we call aseptic meningitis, that don't require antibiotics. And even measles and chickenpox can cause an encephalitis, a brain infection. Before 1985, pediatricians were so competent in doing spinal taps because of infants that were febrile. And it's to find if we had a central nervous system infection. But Neisseria, to me, was so interesting because it came in as a recommendation to give to college students because of that reason. They were living in a dorm. They were living in a high-density place. And I think parents were surprised that we were, you know, giving a new vaccine, and it wasn't completely new, but new-ish, to college students. The first Neisseria meningitis vaccine, that's hard to say, was developed in 1965 and given to the Army in 68 and extended to all the armed forces by 71. But Neisseria meningitis has multiple types, and that was only for one type, type C. And so a better vaccine was made, it's called a conjugate vaccine, and included more types. So then we developed a vaccine to give even to age 2 to 55. And then, of course, now we give it to infants. But basically, when we started, you know, giving it to the college students, and now we gave it to 11 to 15, and now we give it, like I said, to babies. So what was your experience with Neisseria meningitidis or meningococcemia, which is actually more serious?
For meningitis caused by that particular pathogen or particular bacteria, what was common, what I learned about in my residency and what I spread now, is the fact that this continues to be, yes, a rare disease, but also an immediately life-threatening disease. You know, to the point where if you get meningitis caused by this bacteria, there's something like 25% of these people die, and the other 75% of them have serious brain damage. It is a no-joke infection. And so what we cover now is five subtypes of this bacteria, A, C, W, and Y, as well as meningitis type B. And we try to do this in a way that limits the amount of pokes that our young adults and teenagers have to go through. But that is kind of how I frame it for my families. I say, hey, this is an insurance policy type of vaccine for your 11-year-old. And so, and that's kind of when we start in our clinic, is at 11. And then we have the kind of college dose as well. All that to say, we know is that the infection rates of Neisseria meningitidis are declining. And in fact, we're already declining before the vaccine came out. However, again, if you are the rare person to get this this infection, it is just bad news. And so when you weigh that risk, you have to keep that in mind. We're not just talking a cold. We're not just talking something else that you can recover from yourself. It is an awful disease. And so that's how I frame it. The other reason we give it to those age groups is, just like you said, it originated in the military with closed, confined quarters. And if you have a college student or a college athlete, or if you have a high school athlete, again, going back to those 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, they are in close quarters, all that kind of stuff, sharing equipment, in the huddle, you know, and this stuff spreads like wildfire. It's really contagious. So,
do you give it the shot, the vaccine, also to your 2, 4, and 6-monthers?
The 2, 4, and 6 prevention against meningitis is still focused on pneumococcal bacteria as well as Haemophilus influenza type B. And I always have to clarify, when I say Haemophilus influenza type B, you hear the word influenza, that is not the flu. This is just the same name, the same word for Haemophilus, which is a bacteria.
Okay.
So, yeah,
that's the other bacterial meningitis I was going to bring up, the Haemophilus influenza, and I say the same thing about it. It's not influenza, it's a bacteria, and strep pneumonia or pneumococcus. It's interesting because adults who get the pneumonia shot, it's the strep pneumococcal shot. But anyway, so
that's right.
That's another thing to can talk about.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. The pneumococcal vaccine, in fact, and it was the number one cause of meningitis, bacteremia, which is bacteria in your blood making you really sick, and pneumonia was the pneumococcal bacteria. And at the time when they were creating this vaccine, the cases were, I have the numbers here, 5 million ear infections, 40 to 50,000 hospitalizations for pneumonia, 17,000 cases of bloodstream infections, 700 cases of meningitis, and 200 deaths a year going on until we developed these immunizations. Now, the pneumococcal vaccine was in 2000 and it had a success rate of 95% decrease. It's huge.
Just amazing.
Incredible.
One of the things I just want to throw out there is
please.
The maybe wrong information, but the information stream again says that there's toxic things in the immunizations themselves.
Yeah.
And that scares parents. But if they knew what the disease was that was being prevented, that would be even scarier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you're fighting against misinformation and the fear mongering sort of thing.
And it comes back to humility for me and empathy for me. Empathy for my families and how afraid they are. Empathy for being a parent and knowing, understanding this is the most important thing I'm ever going to do in my life. And I don't want to mess up and I don't want to make a bad choice. And so I think, unfortunately, what gets weighted and what gets popular is the certainty that your child is going to have some sort of toxic effect from a vaccine. And remember when we were talking about Sid's death is, of course, you'll have the vast majority of people who didn't do these immunizations, and they tell me all the time, well, I didn't get this. And, absolutely, that's true. 100%, of course, that's true. But when they're talking about the toxins in these vaccines, et cetera, people are representing this information, again, without humility, saying your child is going to get this chronic disease because of the vaccine, guaranteed. And they are not willing to get to the nitty-gritty of the data that says, whatever that risk factor is. And I can tell you, when you compare the completely theoretical and disproven toxic stuff to the disease itself, again, you're weighting small risk against bigger risk. But again, we all need to be very humble with the information that we're given, with the recommendations that we make, and we need to be really humble and empathetic towards our families. And it is... it's discouraging to see the public influence that folks have when they're so certain on their Facebook reels, whatever it might be, about this is going to happen to your child if you immunize them. That is not humility.
No. And just an example is when my son was born, there's mercury in the immunizations. Well, it turns out there isn't anymore, or there isn't mercury in. And understanding maybe the human body, that it can get rid of stuff too. It doesn't mean that little child's body is going to have a toxic stuff in them for long. It's just a reaction, to help them be immunized against very bad diseases.
Well, it was actually the wrong mercury, because it's methyl mercury that can make you sick, and it's ethyl mercury that was in the vaccines.
Right.
So information is important.
It was incorrect information right from the beginning.
I encourage my families to be curious.
Yeah.
Just to stay curious and to say, oh, wow, there's mercury in these vaccines. Wow, that sounds scary. But take it a step further with your curiosity. What kind of mercury? Mm-hmm. Is there mercury that's maybe already in my body? Mm-hmm. Is there, what kind of mercury is in the seafood that poisons people? But what kind of mercury is maybe in this product or products that I already use? Just familiarize yourself. Be even more curious than you are already being. Because when you dig deeper, it becomes a bit more clear.
Yeah. And all the, especially the pneumococcal vaccine that we call Prevnar has been improved. In 2000, there were only seven there are so many different varieties of pneumococcus. There are only seven of the strains, and now there are 20 strains, somewhere between 15 and 20 strains in a vaccine that was developed in 2021. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we're putting new things in the soup and we're going to hurt you. We're putting better things in, and we're not going to hurt you. We're going to prevent bad disease. But I often used examples, and I think that really helps parents in a way. Hmm. I had a mother, a child who, a patient who had a fever on a Saturday night. She didn't call until Sunday, when her child was having a seizure, went to the emergency room and had Haemophilus influenza meningitis the year or two before the vaccine was developed. Mm. So she would go on shows, on TV shows. She would be quoted in the newspaper about how if the vaccine had been available, her son wouldn't be in the nursing home. You know, he was extremely retarded. So meningitis causes retardation, hearing loss, all kinds of nasty things, including death. But if this child survives, they may not be a normal child either. So, and then the pneumococcus, I had a patient, you know, mom who just insisted antibiotics, antibiotics, antibiotics. And, you know, she ended up with a resistant strain of pneumococcus, again, before the vaccine was developed. So
it's an important point. You know, I have, I listen, you know, one of the concerns from many families is, well, you know, why can't we just spend our time coming up for better cures for once I get the illness? And again, we've tried that. We've done that. Antibiotics do exist, but guess what happened? Very quickly, now we have MRSA. Now we have bacteria that are resistant to all the things that I can try to give you. And too, if your concern is giving your infant a medication and wanting to stay away from that kind of stuff, I can tell you that the amount of amoxicillin I'm going to have to give your kid because they keep getting all these diseases and all the medications that you'll end up on if you end up in the hospital with a pneumonia or bloodstream infection far outweighs the dose that we're going to give you to prevent the infection in the first place.
Yeah, so, and now I want to move on to the DPT, and it's interesting. Still, the vaccine injury committee is actually the DPT, the dissatisfied parents together, and that used to be the first source if you went to Google or went to any. I'm sorry, I should say any search engine. So the DPT is now the DAPT. And what does that mean? And the A means it's acellular. So yes, the DPT did make some children irritable, some children febrile, but it didn't cause, if you go to the National Vaccine Injury Committee or whatever they are, they talk about all the serious injuries that kids had with the DPT. Well, anyway, the DPT doesn't exist anymore, but it also didn't cause statistically all those cases. Yes, children were irritable, or yes, they were febrile. They might have had a febrile seizure, which is scary, but it's not serious if it's simply a febrile seizure. So now we have the acellular product, and the nice thing is that we have the acellular product for in the adult form. Mm-hmm. So when parents say they get a tetanus shot, they usually did get a little D and a big T, meaning diphtheria, half dose of diphtheria and a full dose of tetanus. Now they get the D. I hope every pharmacy or doctor's office is stocking this. Little D, little A, little P, and big T. Mm-hmm. So it's recommended by, and I love the fact that OBGYNs are now recommending parents and grandparents to get that shot.
Yeah, it's a good one. I think it's particularly salient to our community, not this winter, but the winter before. My clinic diagnosed a number of children with pertussis, which is whooping cough. And I'd seen it once before in my career as a medical student down in Southern California in an immigrant child. And it's incredible that I'm finding those same sorts of diseases that I was finding in immigrant children in large rates up here in Northern Idaho, where it could be so much different. And so I reflect that. I think the DTaP, again, diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis is such an important one. And it's one when my families, you know, come with me at the common line. We only want the, you know, the good ones or the minimal ones or the common vaccines, et cetera? Which ones would you have me do? Particularly for our community, I'd like to point them towards our Panhandle Health District information and say, hey, go ahead and look at the rates and see which diseases are common in your area. And that'll help us all decide what we want to do. And of course, in my clinic, I always plug that my children are immunized, and I just love preventative. I love preventative medicine. Also, I'm going to stay empathetic towards your goals as a parent. So that is one of them that I really, really, really love because it keeps our kids healthy, particularly in our area.
Yeah, it's so interesting that pertussis or whooping cough just keeps recycling. And little disadvantage, the DAPT, the newer shot, might give you a shorter term immunity, meaning fewer years. But that's why if you stay in a practice, we do have booster recommendations. Mm-hmm. And so follow the doctor's advice, and then you will be, taken care of. And John and I, my husband and I, have had our DAPTs and have had boosters for it because it's been 10 years or more than 10 years. So we do look at it and get boosted every 10 years since we have children and grandchildren.
And I'll plug another one for pregnant women during RSV season. There is an immunization for you that you can take while you're pregnant during a few certain weeks if your child is going to be born during RSV season that allows you to build immunity, pass that immunity through your placenta as well as through your breast milk to your baby to prevent RSV. And it is incredible. Absolutely amazing. And then two, if you did not happen to get that immunization, we now have immunoglobulins, which are antibodies that we can give directly to your infant. It's not a vaccine. It's not asking your baby to create their own immune reaction to the immunization. We are just giving them immunity towards RSV. And I have seen that shot keep very preterm infants out of the hospital. It's incredible stuff. And so I will plug it. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's amazing. And to define for our listeners, RSV is respiratory syncytial virus, and it often causes a bronchiolitis, which means a lung disease. So you're getting actually a lower respiratory. You think your child has a cold, and then suddenly they just cough, 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 cough. A lot of children are diagnosed with asthma because they're so wheezy, and they end up in the ER. They might end up in the hospital with bronchiolitis. So
that's right.
RSV is the cause of bronchiolitis. Just a short blurb on polio. I just saw that the CDC has issued some travel restrictions to countries, and initially it included the UK, Germany, and Spain. So they definitely recommended, to check the CDC website, which is okay, on travel information. And basically, if you're, over 55 or 60 and you're traveling to one of these countries, to get a polio booster, because we had polio when we were all very young. And so there is a booster available. We've talked about RSV. On the DPT, just, be sure you keep up with your DAPTs, whether it be for the children or for the adults, because I think, again, pertussis just... Oh, and just another brief thing about pertussis, because whooping cough. I had a nurse mom, and her baby was 5 weeks old, and she had a cough in the winter. She thought, I just have a cough after a virus. Her child ended up on a ventilator at Children's Hospital with pertussis, because 5 weeks was younger than the normal recommendation to give the shot.
Poor thing.
We did HPV when I talked about cervical cancer in January, but it's so interesting to me and so wonderful that we actually have a vaccine that prevents cancer. And it's... oral cancer, genital cancer, anal cancer, whatever. And it is so, so effective. So I know it's a hard sell to parents for kids 11 and up, but you get better immunity the younger you get it.
That's right.
So, I'm a big proponent of the HPV vaccine. What do you say?
Yeah, I tell a lot of my families, particularly if we start those discussions at 11 years old, and what I tell them is I'm not recommending the immunization against human papillomavirus, because I think that your child in the next few years is going to be exposed to this virus. That is not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that their immune system works better with this immunization right now than it will when they turn 15. And to represent that, it takes two shots to be fully immune from HPV if you start before the age 15. If you start age 15 and up, it actually takes three shots. So our immune system is a pretty incredible thing in the fact that honestly, our infants and children have incredible immune systems, and it already starts to wane, even as early as 15, which is kind of representative there from that immunization. So that's kind of how I talk about HPV to my families.
Well, and it's, oh, my child's never going to have sex as a teenager. It's like, do you follow them around? Basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, we hope that they will. You'll teach them not to. You'll do everything you can, but I don't know what's going to happen.
Sure.
At certain ages. Just a smidge about family trauma that we're doing a lot. Pediatricians are being more attentive now to traumatic events. I talked about it a little bit in a show when we had talked about child abuse, but adverse child experiences study just show that trauma and abuse and family instability can affect brain development and long-term health. So, you know, that's again why pediatricians are more alert to this and talking about it. I just thought it was interesting on adoptions that parents always thought if they adopted from outside the United States, they would be the savior, but they really didn't take into account the trauma that the child had suffered before they were adopted.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, that was a pretty large study, 1998, 10,000 patients kind of reviewing experiences that they had as children and trying to see, you know, what the rates were. If you had a history of abuse or if your parent was incarcerated, et cetera, or if your parent had a drug problem or a mental illness. And the more times you said yes to any of those events, I mean, it's a 4 to 12-fold increase for health risks for alcoholism, drug abuse, depression, et cetera, if you had those experiences as a child. Now, again, when you read into this kind of stuff, this is not predictive. We're not saying that because you had these childhood experiences, you're going to be depressed and an alcohol user. That's not an alcoholic. That's not what we're saying. However, we're using it as a tool, like you said, to be more alert as pediatricians to say, hey,
why is that child so sad?
That's right. You know, that's right. That's right.
Well, I think we're running out of time. So a sincere thank you to Dr. Andrew Viscar, pediatrician from Kinexu Community Health, to help me feature the changes in baby care and child care as I feature National Pediatric Safety Month. And thank you all for listening. Please do remember this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. If you missed any part of the program, catch the show at krfy.org under the podcast tabs. I hope you'll join me again on the first or third Monday of July.